Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who is intelligence, in every sense of the word, I have come to respect greatly, particularly as a result of his service both in the uniform of the United States Army and now as the director of investigations for a simply indispensable organization. It's called Judicial Watch. Has made him one of the people who I consider to be, well, of singular importance to both our understanding of the challenges we're facing and whether we are going to rise to them, as we must. His name is Chris Farrell. He has served, as I say, in the United States Army with a specialization in counterintelligence, which serves him well in his present mission, heading up for Tom Fitton investigations at Judicial Watch. He is an authority on a whole host of issues, domestic and foreign, and we've had the privilege of talking with him over the years, often, not as often as I'd like, but with some regularity. He's always gracious with his time, particularly so today when we're going to take a full hour of it to discuss with him his new book, which is an extraordinary history, looked at through the prism of an extraordinary man. It's entitled Exiled Emissary, George H. Earl III, Soldier, Sailor, Diplomat, Governor, Spy. Chris Farrell, what a fascinating individual you've chosen to profile, and what a story you've painted in terms of his place in history, that is to say George Earl's, but also the history of his time. It's a fascinating book, and I'm so appreciative that you're giving us time to talk with you about it. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. It's a great opportunity, and it's always good to talk to you. And it's even more important, I think, to talk about a guy, George Earl, who, you know, there should be airports and bridges named after him. He's a guy who was an incredible figure in the 1930s and 40s, really even up into the 50s. But he was probably one of the first people to be erased or to be canceled for crossing FDR. And he was sort of a figure who was Trump before Trump. He was an independently wealthy businessman from Philadelphia, kind of a playboy, really, who got involved with FDR and his administration. And his personal drive catapulted him to the heights of not just national politics, but international intrigue and two things that FDR didn't want to hear about.
Well, I'm anxious to talk about all of that. But to set the stage for us, you have a family connection to George Earl, as I understand it. Tell us about that and how you chose to make him the subject of, obviously, a work of considerable effort on your part.
So when I was a little boy in the 1960s, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, bragged about her husband, my grandfather, Jack Fitzgerald, and Jack Fitzgerald's relationship with Governor Earl. And she always spoke so highly of Governor Earl of Pennsylvania. So here's the backstory that got me here. You fast forward, you know, 50 some odd years. My grandfather, Jack Fitzgerald, was a founding member of the New York Coffee and Sugar Exchange. He was a commodities broker on Wall Street. Actually, that exchange was on Pearl Street, nearby Wall Street. But he was a futures guy, a commodities broker. his principal client, his main brokerage activities, and also his good friend, was a guy named George Earle, who came from a very wealthy, old American family. His great uncle was Benjamin Franklin. He's a mainline Philadelphia millionaire. And he owned something called the Flamingo Sugar Mills, which was a very big operation at that time. And my grandfather was his business partner and his friend. And so my grandmother was bragging about Earl, not just because the two of them were pals and business partners, but because Earl had been governor of Pennsylvania. And my grandfather had worked with other colleagues of his on Wall Street in principally around the time starting in March of 1936 in getting then Governor Earl to assist in getting Jewish families out of Nazi Germany. And so this always piqued my interest and I wanted to learn more about it. And you fast forward many decades and I come to find out that there's much more to George Earl. And in fact, that he ended up telling his good friend, Franklin Roosevelt, who he had gone to Harvard with, two things that he didn't want to hear. One was that the war could have ended 18 months earlier, that German intelligence and resistance figures had offered to turn over Hitler, dead or alive, and they wanted to sue for an armistice. And the second thing was that the Katyn Forest Massacre, where 22,000 Poles, the leading cream of the Polish society, had been slaughtered, machine gunned out in a forest in Poland, that actually it was the Soviets who had done it and not the Nazis. And so those are two big sort of elements that came together that inspired a much longer treatment of all sorts of things about George Earle, a really fascinating character.
Well, it is an extraordinary tour of the history of his times, as well as the arc of history of an individual. And you tell it very well, I must say, Chris. So introduce us to this character. He goes from being a playboy to being, a sailor, taking on hazardous duty in a most unlikely craft. Talk about that, if you would, as a starting point.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, he's independently wealthy and comes from a very old family, a very Republican family. When General Black Jack Pershing leads his punitive expedition into Mexico, trying to chase down Pancho Villa, a young George Earle surprises his family and signs up in a Pennsylvania infantry regiment, a National Guard unit that's activated and sent down to the border with Pershing. Earl earns a battlefield commission to second lieutenant while down for those 14 to 16 months in Mexico, returns home eventually. Of course, that whole expedition was a flop, really, in the end, I guess, in the longer historical perspective. They never did grab Pancho Villa, but nonetheless, Earl goes down, volunteers, gets a battlefield commission, comes home. Well, shortly thereafter, of course, we get involved in World War I. And again, Earl's sense of adventure and spirit, he goes and takes his uncle's yacht and offers it as a naval reserve vessel and goes out off the coast of New Jersey and Delaware using the yacht as a submarine hunter. The USS Victor, it is rechristened. Earl gets a commission as a Navy ensign, and he's out off the coast on submarine patrol or anti-submarine patrol, and in the course of his service wins the Navy Cross, which is just one step below the Congressional Medal of Honor. It's an extraordinary thing.
He was hunting submarines, I suppose, German U-boats, without any armaments on his vessel. Is that right? So this was,
No, he was lightly armed. They had some depth charges and a machine gun, and I think a small rifled cannon. But relatively speaking, it was a lightly armed vessel.
Yeah, and an unlikely one at that, as I say. A yacht configured for war. So he goes on.
Then he comes home after the war, returns back to civilian life. And he takes care of business. He's got a number of investments, a number of different businesses. Again, this is an enormously wealthy family with all sorts of interests, from the sugar mills to properties to a restaurant chain. They have all sorts of financial interests, and he really tends to that. He also spends a lot of time playing polo. He's a internationally world-ranked polo player. One of his great friends playing polo happens to be George S. Patton, who at the time was an army. In 32, he decides that he wants to support FDR in his run for the presidency, breaking with his family. His family are all kind of dyed-in-the-wool hardcore Republicans.
Who probably hated Roosevelt, as my grandparents did.
Yeah. Absolutely. And but Earl decides, you know, he wants to try something new or try something different. He kind of buys into the FDR, you know, New Deal kind of mentality. And he writes very large checks, very, very large checks, both to FDR personally and to the Democratic Party. You know, what would be millions of dollars now, and subsidizes that campaign. In response or in return for that, upon his election, FDR appoints him to be the U.S. ambassador to Vienna, Austria. And so he's our ambassador in Austria from 33 to 35, an incredibly volatile time where the diminutive little chancellor Dollfuss, a tiny little guy, he's probably, I think, about 5 foot tall, who's trying to hold Austria together and fend off both the Nazis and the communists at the same time, and keep an independent Austria. Earl is right there in the middle of it. He's literally out on the street in the middle of street battles between these two warring factions, reporting back to the United States about what was going on. And he has a very strong independent streak. And so he does things that makes the State Department crazy. He sends messages back to Secretary of State Hull and says things like, unless I hear otherwise from you by 12 noon tomorrow, I intend on doing the following. And so that sort of independent streak and that sort of the ultimatum type cable back to the State Department makes official Washington crazy. They can't stand that sort of initiative and drive. But that's how Earl operated. You know, he had his set of ideas and he was going to go forward with it. And if you didn't like it, well, you know, tough luck. So by 35, he decides he wants to be governor of Pennsylvania. So he leaves his diplomatic post.
And comes back. Let's just governor. Just take a break here just to reintroduce who it is we're talking about. Chris Fennell is the author of Exiled Emissary, George Earl, Soldier, Sailor, Diplomat, Governor, Spy. And you've now gotten us up to 1935, and he's already been a soldier, a sailor, a diplomat, and you're talking about the run-up to World War II, and he finds himself in a very interesting place in Austria. Carry on.
Sure. So, of course, this is Austria pre-Anschluss, so pre-absorption by Nazi Germany, And there's a very great fight internationally and, frankly, even nationally with Austria's own identity. They're in a squeeze play between Nazis and communists, you know, sort of opposite sides of the same coin, really, in the sense that they're all socialists. But which flavor of socialism is it? But up through from 33 to 35, he's in the thick of it. He's reporting back as to what's going on in Austria. In 35, he's approached by friends back in Pennsylvania who say, hey, listen, you have this tremendous horsepower and connection to FDR and the Democratic Party, and we want you to run for governor of Pennsylvania. So he does. He leaves his ambassadorial post, comes back to
as a Democrat, needless to say, right?
Home base. Yes. And so he comes back. He is the first Democrat elected to governor of Pennsylvania in something like 80 years. And so he's a one-off, certainly, in that regard. But he comes home, is very popular in Pennsylvania. He advances a civil rights bill in 1935 that arguably 30 years later, you know, the U.S. was nationally was only grappling with. And so he saw injustices, like technically under the law in Pennsylvania in the 1930s, a black man was not able to sue a white man. And Earl found this outrageous and said, you know, we're going to level the playing field. And so he instituted reforms like that. He instituted reforms in things like coal mining and steel production, where there were strikes, there was a lot of internal domestic turmoil. And he always tried to strike the balance between legitimate workers' rights and interests, along with those of the business owners. So he was not a lefty in the sense of being sort of a socialist communist. He was sort of this is really the old school loyal opposition Democrats that we don't even have today in this country any longer.
Liberal in the best
this
sense
was a
of the
guy
word.
Who was out for the right. I mean, he was out for the little guy and respected that, but he absolutely loathed socialism and communism. So he's a remarkable governor, serves one term. He actually, in 1936, hosted the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia for FDR and was really looked at as sort of the heir apparent to run for the presidency in 1940.
If Roosevelt would ever stop
FDR,
running. Go
right,
ahead, Chris. Sorry.
He steps aside and allows or acquiesces to FDR's desire to take a unprecedented third term as president. But Earl was definitely in the running and probably could have and perhaps should have won the presidency on his own, but allows FDR to step in there and monopolize or take control of that.
As the nation was heading to war.
That, correct. And on the heels of that, once Earl finishes up as governor, FDR reappoints him as an ambassador yet again. And he goes to Sofia, Bulgaria, and really is instrumental in being FDR's eyes and ears in the Balkans in the lead up right up to our involvement in the war. And there's some pretty crazy stories of his adventures in the Balkans during that time period.
And again, this is where kind of his interest in and practice of espionage, I think, began to manifest itself rather forcefully, and necessarily so. And one of the things that I was struck by, Chris, is he was very clear-eyed about the prospects that we were going to compel Japan to go to war against us by some of the steps that FDR was taking. Essentially to cut off their access to oil and gas and so on from the Dutch East Indies. Talk a little bit about that and how
rubber,
that
all the
was
raw materials that needed.
Yeah, for war, among other things. But talk a little bit about his insights into sort of these kinds of developments and how he would be vindicated by history.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about Earl, and this also makes the State Department crazy, is that he has a very keen awareness of the very desperate need for economic development. You know, in these countries that we're talking about in the walk up to World War II, you know, Earl's solution to a lot of the problems is, well, why don't we just have economic development? Let's have flourishing capitalism, and that will alleviate all sorts of problems and strife and pressures. And the United States was in a position to do that. So he would do things like either encourage or lead trade missions. He would have businessmen from these countries either come and visit him while he was ambassador, either in Vienna or in Sofia, or he would dispatch them off to the United States with his blessing and endorsement, because he was a firm believer that if we could implement and encourage and give access to capital and grow capitalistic business practices in these countries, a lot of the turmoil and inner strife that would end up driving other countries to war would evaporate. And of course, this sort of thinking, official Washington under FDR could not even imagine that access to capital and the promotion of capitalism as a solution, that, you know, it's an economic question, but it also solves, or at least reduces, a lot of the political strife, which was driving countries to war in the walk-up to World War II.
Well, this is, of course, a proposition that was tested with China a few decades later and has come up wanting, but it was sort of a globalist approach back in the day, before that was a thing, I guess one might say. But when you get to World War II, he served in some interesting capacities in that conflict as well. Give us a flavor of George Earle's role during that particularly important period of time.
So upon the attack on Pearl Harbor, December of 41, Earle is our ambassador in Sofia, Bulgaria. And he obviously is then forced to leave Bulgaria. He goes to Istanbul, Turkey, then a neutral city, remains a neutral city throughout the Second World War, but eventually makes his way back to the United States. He volunteers to go back into the Navy again and does so. He arrives in North Africa aboard a troop ship in support of the invasion of North Africa, Operation Torch, and bumps into his old polo playing buddy, George Patton. He hangs around with Patton and ends up hand carrying a 10-page single space letter from Patton back to FDR. And of course, Patton knows that Earle and FDR are personal friends. And so he sends this letter back with Earle to the president. It's a fascinating letter. There's photos included in it. It's an amazing document. But while Earle is visiting with the president, he says to him, "Hey, listen, I want to be the naval attaché in Istanbul." Yeah, FDR tells Earle that he is his emissary to the Balkans and the deputy naval attaché in Istanbul, which of course is very thin diplomatic cover to allow Earle to operate or to continue to operate in the Balkans, collecting intelligence, being the eyes and ears for FDR. While he's there, here's the interesting, here's the hook. This is the game changer. In January of 1943, FDR meets with Churchill in Casablanca. They have a conference there. And FDR announces that the only way he will accept the end to the war is if the Germans unconditionally surrender, meaning, you know, no bargained peace, no armistice, no honorable way out. They have to collapse, basically, and fold their cards completely to the Allies. This makes that announcement really makes the German officer corps very, very concerned, because now there's no bid for peace. There's no armistice. There's no negotiation. There's no way out other than utter defeat. And that really backs them into a corner. So FDR makes this announcement in the second week of January of 1943. At the same time, Earle is arriving in Istanbul. Earle takes out an entire floor of a hotel because, of course, he's independently wealthy. And so he has a very grand lifestyle in Istanbul. And in his hotel room on the suite that he has, one evening, there's a knock at his door, and he opens the door, and standing before him is the head of German military intelligence, Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. Pretty astounding stuff. And Canaris approaches Earle and says to him, "We understand your position here in Istanbul." And of course, they know he's been an ambassador twice. He's been governor of Pennsylvania. He's personal friends with FDR. And so they're using him, the Germans would like to use him as a channel or a conduit. And so Canaris says to Earle, "We will give you Hitler, dead or alive, and his inner circle." And when he says "we," he's talking about the German resistance. "We'll give you Hitler, dead or alive, if we get two things. Number one, we want an armistice. Forget this unconditional surrender thing. We want to have an agreed to peace. And then we need to turn around, literally, and attack the Soviet Union. We need to defeat the Red Army. They're the real threat. They're the threat to civilization. They're the threat to Western society that we, you know and appreciate. Christendom, if you want to think of it that way. They viewed the Soviet Union as the great threat. They knew that Hitler was a monster and wanted him removed, but they wanted a different ending. Earl is, of course, fascinated and excited by this offer. And so he sends it back via two different channels to FDR and hears absolutely nothing in response.
And the question occurs, of course, Chris Farrell, why would FDR not be very interested in and responsive to such an approach through an emissary who he clearly valued and regarded as an ally?
This is a key point in understanding World War II, sort of the history and the turning point of the war. The Allies, in particular FDR, but also Churchill, were always very interested in supporting underground and resistance and partisan movements throughout Europe, actually all around the world, but principally Europe. And they always supported anti-Nazi partisan groups or underground or resistance movements, but they never, ever supported anti-communist resistance movements. And so in this regard, Canaris and the group that he really represented in the German resistance of the Widerstand movement, they were anti-Nazi. They loathed Hitler. They viewed him as being an absolute monster. But they also knew exactly what was for. And they wanted the Soviets removed as well. And that was simply unacceptable because of FDR's relationship with Stalin and, of course, our quote-unquote ally.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over 160 retired Flag Officers for America have recently called for the resignation of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They deemed it warranted by General Mark Milley's unconscionable failure of leadership with respect to racist training and purges of military personnel and America's strategic defeat in Afghanistan. The case for terminating General Milley has become even more clear-cut and urgent, however, thanks to as yet unrefuted claims in a forthcoming book entitled Peril. We're told he sought to allay improbable Chinese concerns that President Trump would launch a nuclear strike after losing the 2020 election by promising to forewarn his counterpart of any attack. Such a warning would almost certainly give aid and comfort to our enemy and probably result in immense loss of American lives. If it happened, that amounts to treason and would justify Mark Milley's overdue firing and a court-martial. This is Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Chris, one piece of this, which in addition to the personal relationship that FDR was cultivating with Stalin, Uncle Joe, as he was famously depicted, despite what a monster he was, despite what he did to his own people, let alone what he was doing, among other things, as you say, to the Poles and countless others, there were people inside the Roosevelt administration in key positions at the State Department, at the Treasury Department, in the Agriculture Department, thinking of the Pentagon, and certainly in the White House itself, including somebody by the name of Harry Hopkins, who was essentially the co-president, according to some, during a period of the war years, lived in the White House with the president, who were either very deeply aligned with the Soviets or were, in some cases, actual agents of the Soviet Union. To what extent was Earl aware of the presence of these, pro-Russian, pro-Soviet persons? And to what extent did he recognize that this was one of the problems he was confronting as he tried to persuade FDR to take seriously an overture like this by Canaris?
Yeah, Earl came to a late realization of how bad it was in the FDR White House, how far over to the left and to the sort of pro-Stalin mindset. He initially thought that Harry Hopkins would be a friend and an ally in getting his cables and messages in front of the president. He found out very bitterly later that Hopkins had actually kind of dead-ended some of his communications. So Earl then used Navy channels to communicate with FDR's naval aide, two aides, Admiral Leahy and Admiral Brown, and was more successful communicating that way. So in March of 1945, Earl returns back to Washington to brief FDR. He had two Oval Office meetings with FDR. Both of them were quite unpleasant. Earl respected the presidency, but he also knew FDR as a personal friend. So he was quite frank with him, and they had very strong words back and forth. The last one, the March of 45 meeting, it becomes plainly evident to Earl that he had met with Forrestal, who was the war secretary, later the defense secretary. And Forrestal warns Earl that, as he referred to it, the whole White House has gone pink, which is sort of 1940s slang for that there are a bunch of Reds, a bunch of communists in the White House. So Forrestal and one other very key factor, a key character, a guy named Bill Bullitt, who had been a longtime diplomatic figure, had been our ambassador in Moscow and in Paris. Bill Bullitt's also a friend of Earl's, both Philadelphia guys. Bullitt and Forrestal warned Earl that the White House, the people around the president, had gone hard over to the left in support of Stalin, and this alarms him.
I'm sorry, in support of what?
It alarms, Earl gets this very clear awareness now that the White House had gone hard over to the left.
Yeah, in support of Stalin and maintaining cordial relations with him, which meant more or less doing his bidding, which contributed materially to post-war outcomes that were terrible for the people of Europe, Eastern Europe most especially, brought up to a divided Germany, but also arguably for our interests there as well. And in due course, in Asia too, where it gave rise to the triumph of the communists in China, thanks in no small measure to some of these same Soviet agents around Roosevelt and then around Truman after he passed away.
So I think it's important to understand that if When you look at World War II, the war in Europe was predicated upon an unconditional war guarantee by Britain and France to protect Poland. If Poland was invaded, that was going to be the tripwire, which would bring in Britain and France to the aid of the Poles. And that's the fact. I mean, that is what was the tension point. And so when the Germans invade Poland in September of 39, that initiates the war because of this war guarantee on the part of the Brits and the French. Well, what's often forgotten is that in September of 39, as the Germans invade Poland, guess who's invading from the other side of the country? Who's invading from east to west is the Soviet Union, because at that point, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union were allies. And when we get to the very end of World War II, you know, 6 years of bloodshed later, one of the parties that initiated the war, who waged a war of aggression, was the Soviet Union. And what did FDR do?
In league with Poland. Hitler and his Nazis. No, that's absolutely right. We completely ignore that.
He gives Poland to Stalin.
He gives Poland, among other places, to Stalin, as it turns out. And then, of course, we did see this tragic story playing itself out again a few years after World War II in China, and the rest, as they say, is history. So just to tie up your wonderful biography, Chris Farrell, of George Earle, entitled Exiled Emissary. He finished up the war in another unlikely place, out in the Pacific. How did that come to pass, and what transpired in the remainder of his long life?
So George Earle has really sort of a blowout fight, a shouting match in the Oval Office in March of 45 with FDR, not only over the armistice approach of the underground, the German underground, but also over the Katyn Forest massacre, which Earle had investigated at FDR's request. FDR refused to believe that the Soviets did it, and he and Earle get in quite a fight over it. Earle then threatens to go public. He says he wants to tell members of Congress the truth about what's been going on with the Soviet Union, and FDR then banishes him, literally. He withdraws his personal emissary status from him in a written letter and tells the Navy to send him out to Samoa, 7,000 miles out into the Pacific, really to cancel him, to shut him up, and to make him unable to communicate the truth about what the Soviet Union was doing.
Banished, in other words. And did it work?
It did, to a large degree. I guess it's bad to say, fortunately, FDR died, but nonetheless, he did die about 3 months later. Earle then returns to the United States promptly thereafter. And he continues for years, all the way through the 40s into the 50s, and actually into the mid-60s, being a very strong anti-communist, speaking out, organizing, going into various groups and promoting the truth about what was really going on with the Soviets. Fascinating post-war career, but because of the weight of FDR against Earle and trying to shut him up and really cancel him, it's part of an early cancel culture. He essentially becomes an obscure figure.
It was a very important touchstone, though, I think, for a number of FDR Democrats who were not enamored of the communists. I'm thinking of John Kennedy. I'm thinking of my old boss, Scoop Jackson, for example, Hubert Humphrey, to a point, who were similarly very hardline. George Meany of the labor union movement, of course, very hardline on the communists, and properly so. We could talk more about all of this, and it is worthy of further conversation, as you make very clear in this wonderful and very engaging biography about an extraordinary human being, George Earle, Chris, and I just can't say enough about how much I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. But I did want to take advantage of your expertise, your insights both into his personal story and your present work with Judicial Watch to talk about a problem that I think is very much one of our own time. And that is another communist power that has succeeded in a manner that makes the Soviets in their heyday pale by comparison, I think, with respect to the kinds of influence operations and penetration and subversion of our government that has been accomplished by the Chinese Communist Party. Again, that party that came to power in no small measure thanks to Soviet agents back in the latter days of World War II and then afterwards. Chris, you, again, devoted some of your professional life to counterintelligence in the United States Army. You've kept your hand in the business of investigations. You're among the country's foremost investigators of wrongdoing. What do you make? We're going to talk about this. Sorry, let me skip that. What do you make of the extent to which the Biden administration, from literally the president himself on down, seems to be, well, at least deeply compromised by, if not quite closely aligned with, what we call the CCP?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, the president's son has made two separate multi-billion-dollar deals with the communist Chinese government. And we're supposed to pretend that there's no consequence, no influence, no repercussions, no consideration, no connection between the president's son, who personally is a train wreck. And I don't begrudge him that. I think he has serious addiction issues and personality disorder type stuff that he needs to work on. But the fact remains, he made 441 trips with his father using Secret Service protection. He made 29 foreign trips, and he made 5 trips to China with his father, and then engaged in 2 separate multi-billion-dollar deals with the Chinese Communist government. His business partner alleges that, quote, the big guy, close quote, got a 10% cut in those deals. That seems to indicate the big guy is the president now. But we're supposed to just turn a blind eye and say, oh well, never mind. Nothing to worry about here. Move along. And it's preposterous. I mean, it is painfully a threat and a danger to our country. But if you raise the question, if you ask, you know, questions about the issues and the relationships, you're branded a conspiracy theorist nut.
It ain't true, needless to say, especially as you say, with the evidence that's available. And by the way, as I'm fond of pointing out to our audience, Chris, we've got quite a corpus of documentation in a web platform called accountabilityinitiative.org on a host of these Biden appointees who have been working with, tied to, employed by, paid by, or otherwise in some way implicated by the Chinese Communist Party. And it's really vital that we understand what's going on here and, as you say, the implications of it. And from the perspective of an intelligence professional, Chris, when you have individuals, for example, a Hunter Biden, let's say, or through Hunter, his father, compromised by agents of a foreign power like communist China, what can that translate into in terms of policy impact? And is what we're seeing happening, I just would offer this as just one example, in Afghanistan at the moment, the kind of thing that one would associate with such an intelligence play?
Yeah, I mean, there's 2 things in Afghanistan that are worth talking about. One is, why in the world would we abandon an airbase that provides us a platform, an incredibly valuable platform militarily, intelligence-wise, and other applications. That is a base 400 miles from China's back door and 500 miles from Iran. Why would we simply pack up and walk away from our own very robust capability, you know, blood, sweat, and tears poured into that base? It's the only thing we had going, really, in all of Southwest Asia. And why would we simply abandon it? I mean, that's one point. Second point, you know, for all the blood, sweat, and tears poured into Afghanistan, you know, one of the, I guess, only things Afghanistan has going for it, supposedly now, is rare earth minerals. And, you know, China practically has a stranglehold on those. Why would we abandon that resource?
It is not, unfortunately, being clarified, at least so far, in the conversations that the Congress has had with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. But we do need answers to those questions. And more to the point, we need, I think, corrective action taken with respect to individuals, including Tony Blinken, who do have these compromises in their background. Chris, when you look at more broadly the state of our polity, and you evaluate the kinds of challenges that we're facing domestically, how high a priority do you personally assign to the threat posed by white supremacism in our nation?
You know, it exists, but the notion that somehow it's our chief law enforcement or, you know, intelligence priority is preposterous. Yes, there are groups that are radical and militant. They deserve to be investigated and watched, especially those espousing violence against persons or property, like any other group. But the notion that somehow that's the that entity or that sort of strain of thinking is the chief threat to the Constitution is preposterous. And when I see things like Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Milley testifying about how he wants to learn about white rage, and then in the same breath mentioning the January 6th protests, that's really wildly dangerous stuff. That is reckless and irresponsible, very disingenuous, or it's a very deliberate act on the part of Milley. I'm not sure whether Milley is a dupe. He's just sort of an unwitting idiot, a useful idiot, as Lenin would say, or whether he's actually on board with this effort to reset and rewrite the Constitution. I don't know where he is.
I don't either, but we'd better get to the bottom of it, because it turns out he's not been terribly impressive as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in dealing with his actual principal responsibility, which is protecting the American people and their vital interests, including in places like Afghanistan. Chris, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more we could talk about. So appreciate being able to have a visit with you at length, and I hope you'll come back to us again soon. In the meantime, congratulations once again on really required reading. Exiled Emissary, George Earl, Soldier, Sailor, Diplomat, Governor, Spy. Come back to us again if you would soon, Chris. In the meantime, keep up the great work you do at Judicial Watch. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat, This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Over 160 retired Flag Officers for America have recently called for the resignation of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They deemed it warranted by General Mark Milley's unconscionable failure of leadership with respect to racist training and purges of military personnel and America's strategic defeat in Afghanistan. The case for terminating General Milley has become even more clear-cut and urgent, however, thanks to as yet unrefuted claims in a forthcoming book entitled Peril. We're told he sought to allay improbable Chinese concerns that President Trump would launch a nuclear strike after losing the 2020 election by promising to forewarn his counterpart of any attack. Such a warning would almost certainly give aid and comfort to our enemy and probably result in immense loss of American lives. If it happened, that amounts to treason and would justify Mark Milley's overdue firing and a court-martial. This is Frank Gaffney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
He was the only U.S. president to also serve as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. After the Spanish-American War, he was appointed the first governor of the Philippines. President Theodore Roosevelt appointed him Secretary of War. The largest president, weighing over 300 pounds, a bathtub was installed for him in the White House big enough to hold four men. His name was William Howard Taft, and he was born this day, September 15, 1857. President Taft stated, "A God-fearing nation like ours owes it to its inborn sense of moral duty to testify devout gratitude to the All-Giver for countless benefits."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.